Okay, good morning. Let's make a start. Glad to see you all here. Welcome. If I could just remind people to turn off their phones, that would be a good start. And also, I'd like to start by thanking our sponsors for the 2021 year. The Shirim is sponsored anonymously in the merit of an aliyah for the neshamas of Maaseiyahu ben Yisrael, Aaron ben Menachem Lev and Eliana Bas Yaakov. Thank you for that sponsorship. As always, very much appreciated. Okay. So, we last week started something quite difficult, and we started looking at Shemitah. We had a foundational shiur where we looked at the basic psukim in the Torah, the mitzvahs, the malachas on a Torah level, the malachas on a rabbinic level, just to recap on that one point which is important, which is that unlike Shabbat, where the avot and the toladot, both the if you like, the headline malacha and its subsidiary, are all on a Torah, prohibited on a Torah level. So on Shabbos, to plant a tree in the garden or to water the tree in the garden are all Torah prohibitions. In Shemitah, we do not pask in that way. In Shemitah, we understand that the avot, planting and sowing and reaping and cutting down the grapes, these are Torah prohibitions. But all the subsidiary malachot, watering and fertilizing and all the other things that help the tree grow, these are all on a rabbinic level. That's going to be important today. We saw that last week. We also started looking at the issue of Kedushat Shviit, which will come up not so much today, but more in a couple of weeks from now. And we looked a little bit at the issue of Tosefet Shviit. I hope that if you were running to plant your tree before last Shabbat, you got there in time and you planted it. It's not too late if it's still in its root ball. We talked about that last week. I'm not getting into that again. Today and next week, I want to really get our head around the issue of the Heta Mechira. The Heta Mechira is probably the most controversial issue in modern-day Shemitah application. And there are a number of important halachic questions that we need to get our head clear on to work out why people say what they say, and a number of important hashkafic and, we'll see today, historical issues. Many times if you just open up the Jerusalem Post or Haaretz or whatever is your, you know, paper or website of choice, you'll see a lot of fighting and back and forth and this shouldn't be allowed and that shouldn't be allowed and the Rabbanut are trying to do this and the... Every year it's a new replay of the same. But we'll see today that many of these Shemitah arguments were, if you like, dyed into the wool early on in the Shemitah debate. We'll see in 1888, 89, that was a very important year. Therefore, what I want to look at today is a little bit of a different kind of shir from normal. It's really a shir, it's like football is a game of two halves, right? Well, this is a shir of two halves. If you didn't get that, that's fine. The first half of the shir is looking at some of the classic halachic issues to do with Heta Mechira, and the second half goes back into the history. Let's have a look. And one of the historical sources, which I strongly recommend to people to have a read through, is this wonderful book called Rebels in the Holy Land by Sam Finkel, which is a beautifully researched and put together, lots of wonderful old photographs, accounts of the early mitnachlim, if you like, the early pioneers in Maskeret Batya, which was one of the early yeshuvim founded by and supported by Rothschild. We'll talk more about Rothschild later. But this is a really great book, and it's very Shemitah focused. The center discussion of the book is how these farmers dealt with the Shemitah year and how they balanced that against the money they were receiving from Rothschild and the old yeshuv and the new yeshuv, and then Rav Kook came later. So I recommend strongly that book as a good read. What's that? Sam Finkel. I think one of his ancestors was one of the people who started up Maaseiyahu ben Batya. So we'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to that in about 20 minutes or so. But now let's get our head around a few issues. What I've done is, rather than try and, you know, do all of the Heta Mechira halachic issues in one week, I'm dealing with two today and two next week. The two I want to deal with today is Shemitah today rabbinic or on a Torah level? The Heta Mechira only really gets started if you assume that Shemitah today is a rabbinic mitzvah, all in, not a Torah mitzvah. If it's a Torah mitzvah, it's much harder to work the Heta Mechira. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, how do we actually count the Shemitah years? Is there an actual question as to whether this coming year really is Shemitah or not Shemitah? That's going to be important. Next week, I want to hit on the head the issue of Svichim. What are these things that grow from the ground that there's a rabbinic prohibition of, and how prohibited really are they? The issue of whether a non-Jew who owns land in Eretz Israel affects
Eretz Israel at all. Also, the Heter Mechira is predicated on the assumption that if you sell the land to a non-Jew, it does something, it changes something. If it doesn't change anything, what did you achieve? In fact, you may have actually achieved something quite negative, because the third issue to next week is, are you even allowed to sell land in Israel to non-Jews? Is that acceptable? You may have seen in the paper a few days ago, I think Rav Shmuel Eliyahu said that it's a mitzvah for people not to buy from non-Jews during Shemitah. It's a slightly different question, but only to buy from Jews. And then there are people in Meretz who want him referred to some racist, you know, a racism body to say, is that acceptable? All these are just new forms of old discussions, which we'll see this week and next week. Let's get into the question, first of all, of historically, how did Shemitah work? This will help us to understand Heter Mechira as we get there. So let's do this quite quickly. It's not actually that complicated, and then we'll get into the history. Number one, says the Pasuk, setting up Shemitah, Debel b'nei Yisrael v'amata aleihem, this is how Shemitah works, ki tavo el haaretz. When you come to the land, then Ashani Nuten Lachem, Veshavta Arish Shabbas Lashem, then there'll be a Shemitah year. So it's quite clear that they did not keep anything like Shemitah. Obviously, they couldn't have done until they got to Israel. Agav, in parentheses, which mitzvahs did they keep in the desert? They kept Pesach specifically in the second year because they were told to, and then they didn't keep it. But did they keep Sukkot? When they were living in Sukkot or in the Anane HaKavod, was there any concept of Sukkot? Was there a concept of Tefillin in the desert? If so, what did they have in their Tefillin? Because the parshas of Tefillin, some of them only appear in Devarim. So is it that those parshas were given? I'm not getting into that. It's a slightly academic debate for our purposes. But Shemitah for sure did not apply until they got to the country. And not only when they got there, but it's clear when they got there, they had to conquer the land. Number two. Kol ha-makom asher tidroch kaf raglechem. You actually have to put your feet on this land. Raglechem bo, lachem yihyeh, that's going to be your land. Min ha-midbar, ha-levanon. And we talked about this in terms of the boundaries. The midbar, the levanon, min ha-nar, nar prat, etc. So it's not good enough to draw theoretical boundaries. They have to actually be taken. Asher tidroch kaf raglechem. You have to actually conquer and own those lands and occupy those lands in order for them to be yours. Similarly, it's very clear, Chazal pick up number three, it has to belong to you. Sheishanim tizra sadecha. For 6 years you have to plant in your field. Vesheishanim tizmor karmercha. It didn't have to say sadecha karmercha vasafta et tvoata. And at the end again, on Shemitah year, sadecha lo tizra v'charmecha lo tizmor. So these two things, both physical conquest and ownership, had to happen. And that's why the land actually had to be conquered and divided up in order for Shemitah to start. Just look for a second in number five. We'll go back to number four in a minute. Says the Rambam, Me'ematai hitchilu limnot. When did they start counting the Shemitah system? Ma'acha arba esrei shana mishinichnasu la'aretz. Only 14 years after they came into the land. Shneimah, as it says, Sheishanim tizra sadecha, Vesheishanim tizmo karmecha, Adshiye kol echad makir et atzo. Every farmer, every tribe, every individual had to know, this is my field, this is my kerem, this is my vineyard. Sheva shanim asu b'kibush haaretz. 7 years it took them, read Sefer Yoshua, it took them to conquer the land. Vesheva shanim b'chiluk, and 7 years to divide up the land. Umanu sheva shmitot, and they counted from year 15, 14 years they were conquering and dividing, from year 15 they started counting, sheva shmitot, v'kitzu shnat ha-chamishim, and they sanctified the 50th year, shehi shnat arba v'shishim v'shinichasu l'aretz. Year 64 was the 50th, quote-unquote, year of Yovel. Okay? 14 years, and then they started counting. What's it got to do with Yovel? Go back to number four. Shemitah seems to be tied up very clearly with Yovel. Number four. V'sefarta lecha sheva shabbatot shanim, sheva shanim, sheva pa'amim. It's not just a unit of seven, but you have to count seven units seven times. V'hayu lecha yimei sheva shabbatot shanim, and these seven Shemitah years will end up as teshva arbaim shanah. It's 49 years. The Kiddush Demet Shnat HaChamishim, you have to sanctify the 50th year, HaChamishim Shana, the 50th year. But Karatim Droba Aretz L'chol Yoshvera, very important word. And you have to cry freedom to all the inhabitants. They have to be actually inhabitants. Yovel Hiti Elachem, it will be a Yovel, a Jubilee year for you. V'shavtem Ish Elachuzata, each person will go back to their ancestral land. V'ish El Mishpachto Ta Shuvu, and each people will go free. The Eved Ivri will go free, etc., etc. How closely connected is Shemitah to Yovel? This for us is a critical question today. Because Shemitah we have, but Yovel we don't have. We'll see why in a minute. We haven't had Yovel for a good long time. In the middle of the first temple period already, Yovel ceased to have effect. So if Shemitah is inextricably linked with Yovel, then as Yovel goes down, Shemitah goes down with it. Or maybe not, we'll see right now. Number six, says the Gemara, D'Tanya, Mishegalu Shevet Reuven v'Shevet Gad v'Chetzis Shevet Menasha Bitlu Yovelus. And this is the halacha, the Rambam passes this in Hilchos Shemitah, that even before the 10 tribes were exiled, when Sancheirav came and took them away, even before that, the tribes of Reuven, Shimon, Gad and Chetzis Shevet Menasha on the eastern side and the east bank of the Jordan, they were taken off. As soon as they were taken away, that's the end of Yovel. Shenama Krasim Drola Ba'aris L'chol Yoshvea Bizman Shekol Yoshvea, only when all the Jewish people are represented on the land, V'loy Bizman Shegalo Mitzasa, not when some of them have already been exiled. Ah, Yochel Hayo Aleh V'hei Mu'uravim, maybe it's good enough that they're all there in a big cholent. Shevet Binyamin B'Yehuda, Shevet Binyamin lives in Yehuda. V'Shevet Yehuda B'Binyamin, Shevet Yehuda lives in the land of Binyamin. Ah, Yehei Yovel Noig, maybe then that's good enough for Yovel to apply. Talmud Lama, no, L'chol Yoshver, Bizman, Sheyoshver, Ketikunan. Everybody has to be in the correct place. V'lo Bizman Shehei Mu'uravim, and not when they're all mixed up. So you see already from the Golas of Shevet Reuven, Gad and Chetzi Shevet Menashe, there is no Yovel anymore. So what do we count? If the count is 49 plus 1, 49 plus 1, 49 plus 1, do we still have the 1? Do we still have the 50th year? So look at what the Rambam says. Over the page to page 2. Says the Rambam. Just a little bit of history here. A little bit of maths as well. In the halacha, he wants you to understand the years. There were 17 Jubilee cycles from when the Jews entered the land of Israel until when they left at the end of the first temple. Meaning there were 16 whole ones and they were in the 17th cycle. And the year that they were thrown out, when the first temple was destroyed, it was the 8th year, it was Motsa Shviyat. And it was year 36 of that cycle. So there were 16 full cycles. If you count up the maths, 16 times 50 is 800. And 36, there were 836 years from when they got into Israel until when they were thrown out. How do you get to that number? Because the Malachim Aleph says there were 480 years from when they left Egypt until the building of the first temple. The first temple we'll see right now is 410 years. So then you get 890, you take off the 40 years in the wonder desert, the 14 years in the division, and you get to the magic number 836. Sha'arba me'od shana, second line, 410 years ve'eser shanim amad bayis rishon. Fine. Now here's the key. Kevan shecharav habayis, batal minyan zeh. According to the Rambam, the minute the temple is destroyed, you stopped, they went into Golas, they stopped counting the Shemitah years completely. Mishebatla nish'eret ha'aretz, charei v'shivim shana, and the land was desolate for 70 years, then v'nivna bayis sheni, and then the second temple was built. So did we start straight away, start Shemitah again? No, not straight away. For Arba Meos for Eshim Shana Amad, the second temple was 420 years, but Ubishana Hashviit, only in the 7th year, Mibinyano of the second temple's building, Allah Ezra came up, because of course the first group that built the second temple was Zerubbabel. And we don't know much about what happened to them. They kind of just disappeared. It didn't really succeed. There was not a klitatova. And then Ezra came in the 7th year, Vihia Biashnir, that is really counts as when the Jews properly came back. Umishana Zah, from when Ezra came back, Hitchilu Limnot Minyanache, they restarted the count. Va'asu Shnat Yud Gimel Lebinyan by Sheni Shmita, and that made the 13th year of the built second temple into the Shmita year, because they only started counting when Ezra came. Umana Sheva Shmita is they counted 7 Shmita years, the Kitsu Shnat HaChamishim, and then they made the 50th year holy for the Yovel. Ah, but there was no Yovel, because we're dealing with now a tiny fragment of the Jewish people. Yehuda, Binyamin, forget about the 10 tribes, they've all gone, says the Rambam, no. Afel pishiloi haita sham Yovel the Bayit Sheni, even though they didn't have Yovel in the Bayit Sheni, even in the first temple for some time, meinim haya osa kadeh lekadesh shmitas. You needed to count a nominal 50th in order for the Shemitah system to work. Shemitah has to work. Whenever you start counting, it has to be 49 plus 1. Whether the 1 is really the true Yovel year with all its excitement, okay, that depends on all the halachic factors. But even if it's not, you still count the 1. It's always 49 plus 1, 49 plus 1, 49 plus 1. Okay? However, life is not so straightforward. The Rambam is taking a position here. The Gemara actually brings two positions, number 8. So the Gemara is asking, what did they do with the Yovel year when there was no Yovel year? Which we've seen in the Rambam just now. Amar of Nachman bar Yitzchak, Manu Yovis Lekadish Shmitin. They counted the Yovel years just to keep the Shemitah count right, even when there was no Yovel. This we saw was the Rambam's position. Ah, says the Gemara, Hanichal Rabbanon. That's good for the position of the Rabbanon. The Amri, they say, Shnat Chamishim Einu Min HaMinyan, that the 50th year is not part of the 7 times 7. Elele Rebbe Yehuda, but don't forget, there's Rebbe Yehuda's opinion. He says, Da'ama, Shnat Chamishim Oile Lekan Ulekan. Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, another Tana, was that the 50th year was an overlap year. You counted 49, and then the Yovel year was the first year of the next 49. It wasn't a separate 50th year. According to them, Lamali, I don't need the 50th year. B'shmitin Sagi, it's good enough just to count 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7. So you see already here two different ways of counting Shemitah and Yovel. Yes, sir.
Isn't the Beresh Pasuk talks about...
It says the 50th year.
50th year?
Yes, good. So what does the 50th year mean? The 50th year, which is then you start again number one after, or does the 50th year mean this is year one of the next 49 cycle? Does not clear in the Pesukim. So the Rambam took a view on this and said it has to be 49 plus 1, even when you're not keeping Yovel properly. But we saw this as a different opinion. Now, according to the Rambam, where are we in Shemitah years? Now, you're going to see the most fascinating thing now. Look at 9 and 10 together. Says the Rambam, Lefi cheshbon zeh, according to all of my calculations, the way I calculate Shemitah, 49 plus 1, etc., Shana Zo, this year, Shehi Shnat Elef Umeya Vesheva, which is 1107 years, L'Churban. He counts it from the Churban by Sheni, which is an interesting word. We don't count the years from the Churban. He counted from the Churban. But he gives you another count in case you're not happy with that. Shehi Shnat Shmonin Vesheva Ve'Elef Arba Me'ois, which is 1487 years, L'Minyan Shtarois, according to the Minyan Shtarois. What was the Minyan Shtarois? The Minyan Shtaros was a very common system of dating in the Second Temple period. It's in Sefer Maccabees already, that there were the when Alexander the Great took over the whole of the Middle East, they started a new count from the beginning of the Seleucid era, from his successor Seleucus. So they counted, which turns out I put in the footnote to be the year 311 BCE, the way we count, was the beginning of the Minyan Shtarot. By the time of the Rambam, this was already waning as a way of counting the years. But we see this in the Cairo Geniza. We see many ksubas and other documents counted with minyan shtarot. Around the 14th, 15th century, the Jews basically stopped using minyan shtarot and started really only using the creation years that we use today, the 5, 7, 8, 2, etc. Two communities continued. The Yemenites continued using minyan shtaros pretty much until modern times, and Lahavdil, the Assyrian church, continued using Minyan Shtaros until modern times. I'm not sure that anyone uses it practically anymore, but for the Rambam, it was very important to use. Shehi, and then he gives you the creation years. Shehi Shnat Shesh V'Shloshim V'Teshim V'Ois V'Arba Alafim. It's 49, 36, the Yetzirah from Bereishis. Okay, good. Why do I care about any of this? This is actually the year, the way we count, 1176 CE. By the way, Minyan Shtaros was really kicked into touch by the Arabs. When the Arabs came and took over the whole area, they restarted an Islamic calendar, and that was the end of that. And they weren't particularly tolerant of anyone who uses other things. But says the Rambam, this year, 1176 CE, as we counted, he Shnat Shemitah. This is a Shemitah year. As he's writing these words, he says, this year is Shemitah year. The Hishnat Achad Va'esra Min HaYovel, and it's actually, the way I count also, it's 21 years into this Jubilee cycle. Very nice. By the way, in parentheses, the Rambam elsewhere in the Mishnah Torah drops in a note of which year it is. Elsewhere in the Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, he writes this also in his introduction, and he puts a different year in each time, and we can see from this that he took him 3 years, at least, to write the Mishnah Torah, because every now and then he puts in the year, and it was 1174, 1175, 1176, except he doesn't use that numbering. Fine. Says the Rambam, according to the halacha, the way I see it, this year is Shemitah year. But, number 10, Aval. Kol ha-ga'onim amru. All the ga'onim, the Babylonian minhag is, shemasored hi b'yadehim. They have a tradition, ish mi pi ish, received one master from the next, shaloi manu ba'oisen ha-shivim shano shebein churban ba'is rishon, u'binyan ba'is shene, ele shmitzis bilvad ben lo yovel. They have a tradition which he says, I think is wrong, halachically, I think you always count 49 plus 1, 49 plus 1, except during the Churban between the first and second, in which case when we stopped. He says they have a tradition that you only count Shemitah years when there's Churban, and you don't count Yovel years. So during the period of the Galus Bavel, between the first and second temple, says the Rambam, I think we shouldn't count at all. But they counted just sevens, not the Yovel. And after the destruction of the second temple, according to their tradition, they don't count Yovel years at all. Every year is just Shemitah, 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 Shemitah. So it's just 49s. There's no ones. There's no 50ths at all. So of course, this comes out to a completely different count to the Rambam's count, because you've missed out all of these Yovel years. So what does he say about that? V'chein, Mishicharev, on second line number 10, Mishicharev v'achrona loy manushnat ha-chamishim, since the second temple was destroyed, they don't count the Yovel year, ela sheva sheva bilva, they just go in units of seven, mitzchilat shnat ha-churban, from the churban. V'chein oyle b'gemara avodah zarah cheshban zeh shehu kabbalah. And there is a mention of this tradition even in the Gemara. So, according to them, next in Vav here, v'shnat ha-shmita yaduah himu for a semis etel ha-goyin, if they publicize this widely, the anshe Eretz Yisrael and the people of Eretz Yisrael follow this minhag, v'kulam loimanu ela l'shnei churban, they just count from the churban, mashlichin oitzah sheva sheva, they just count 7, 7, 7. U'lefi cheshbon zeh tehi shana zo, and according to that cheshbon, this year, which he just told you, was a shmita year according to his count, Shana Zor, Shehishnat Sheva Umeva Elev Churban, which is 1107 from the Churban, Moitzis Shvias. It's actually not the Shemitah year. Says the Rambam, I hold this year is Shemitah year. But they hold that last year was Shemitah year. Va'al Zeh Anu Soimchim. And you know something? We're going to paskin like them. Even though I think they're wrong. U'kefi ha-cheshbon Zeh Anu Moirim. And we're going to paskin the halacha like their cheshbon le'inyin ma'asros of Shvias, when it comes to Maisa, when it comes to Shemitah. The Hashmatas Ksofim and releasing loans. Why? This is a very important meta-halachic point. Sheha Kabbalah, the Hamaisa Amudim Gedolim Bahoira. Because Kabbalah, received tradition, and practical psak on the ground are very important pillars of halachic ruling. More important as far as he's concerned than his theoretical count based on the understanding of the halacha. Ubehem roi lehitalot, and we should rely on that. So the Rambam, fascinatingly, has just told you that even though I think that they're wrong, we're going to go with their count. So now you're left kind of thinking, well, I don't know, is it Shemitah year next year or is it not Shemitah year next year? Halachically, it's Shemitah year, because we paskin this way. Even though the Rambam said it's not really Shemitah year. And you put in the one, do you not put in the one, etc. No, there is no real question in halacha. I'm not trying to make out that this is an unresolved question. It's resolved. Shulchan Aruch follows the Rambam. Everyone agrees next year is Shemitah year. But lurking in the back of our minds is this question, is it... Or isn't it? And in the Hetzer Mechira debate, that's one of the issues which is wheeled out as a kind of, well, and also a sniff lahatir, you never know if it's, etc. So now you know a little bit more about that. The other issue, which actually is much more fundamental, halachically, is whether Shemitah is Doraisa or Drabon. Let's look at this briefly for 5 or 6 minutes, and then we'll get into the history. Gemara, here, Moed Kav, number 11. Says the Gemara, we looked at this last week briefly. Mashkin beis hashlachin b'moed u'b'shvias. You're allowed to water a field during Chol HaMoed and during the Shemitah year. Now, why? Why am I allowed to water a field? On Shabbat, I would not be allowed to water a field. On a Doraisa level. So the Gemara, first of all, it talks about Chol HaMoed. I'm not getting into that now. But Shvias, so Shemitah, this is very difficult. Bein la'anda ama, manda ama mishum zareya. Whether you say that watering is a prohibition of making things grow. Ubein lamanda ama mishum chayrish, or whether watering the ground is a prohibition of chayrish, of preparing the ground to take growth of a plant. Zriya v'charish b'shvis mishari, who said you're allowed to plant and to plow during Shemitah? Just because your field needs water, if watering is part of those halachic prohibitions, why would it be allowed? So he gives two views. Ama Abaya said, b'shvis bizman hazeh. It's talking about Shemitah today, Rashi says. Durabonon. For Rebbe, and it's the position of Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi. Rashi explains in brackets, Dama Dehud Rabbanon, because Rebbe says it's the Rabbanon. Umilsa de Pseida, and since it's now the Rabbanon, all of Shemitah is the Rabbanon, all of Shemitah. And since now you're going to lose all your crops if you don't water them, so then Mikmakom Pseida Shara Rabbanon. Because there's a loss, and it's a rabbinic law, the whole of Shemitah is a rabbinic law, then you're basically allowed to do anything you need in order to prevent a serious financial loss. That's the first Shemitah. Shemitah is the Rabbanon. Rava Amar, and Rava said, no, Afilu Tamer Rabbanon, you can even take the view of the rabbis against Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rashi, the Pligia led the Rebbe, they disagree with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the Amri, and they say, Shvius Bizman Azed Doraita. Shvius is the Raisa today. So if Shvius is a Torah prohibition, how can you water your fields? No. Avos Asa Rachmana, but told us, Lo Asa Rachmana. Because, like I said at the beginning, we saw last week, planting and sowing are the Av Malacha. And watering is a tolada, it's only a subsidiary. And in Hilchos Shemitah, we paskin that the subsidiaries are rabbinic and not on a Torah level. And therefore, you're back to a loss, and it's a rabbinic prohibition. So you don't have to say that all of Shemitah is Darabonon. It's just this particular watering example is a Darabonon, but Shemitah generally is Dioraita. Two opinions. Machlokes Tanaim, Rebbe says Shemitah is Darabonon, Rabbonon says Shemitah is Daraisa. And two, and Machlokes Amoraim. Abaya follows the opinion that it's Darabonon, and Rava follows the opinion it's Doraisa. Who do we follow? The Rambam, unfortunately, we have two different textual variants of the Rambam, which is interesting but annoying. In number 12, which is the Rambam you'll probably find when you open your Rambam back home, it seems to say Shemitah is Doraita today. Look what he says. Bizman Sheha Yovel Noeg, when the Yovel applies. No, then there's all sorts of other things which apply. Noeg din eved ivri, then you can have an eved ivri. Vedin bati arichome, and walled cities, houses in walled cities. Vedin sedei charomim, and fields which are given over to the kohanim. Vedin stei achuzah, fields which go back to their owners after 49 years. Umekablim geratoshav, and we can also accept a geratoshav. Veno heged shviit ba'aretz, and shmita applies, when Yovel applies. Uvehashmatas ksafim, and release of loans. Bechol makam min haTorah. They all apply min haTorah when Yovel applies. And last line, focus here. Ubizman she'ein ha'yovel noeg, when yovel doesn't apply, so what doesn't apply? Ein noeg echad mikol elu, none of the above apply, chutz mishvius ba'aretz, apart from Shemitah, which still does apply, comma, the hashmatas ksafim b'kol makam, and we also release loans everywhere in the world, midivrem on a rabbonon level, kemoshe ve'arun. So according to that Rambam, is Shemitah daraisa or darabonon? Daraisa, it's an exception. Everything is reliant on Yovel in this list, apart from Shemitah, which is an exceptional, like Rava. However, in the Frankel Rambam, he has a different wording. Look at the end here, number 13, the end of that halacha. Bizman she'ena Yovel noig, when there is no Yovel, ena noig eved ivri v'lo bati arichoma v'lo sadi achuzah v'lo sadi charamim v'ein mekablim ger toshav. Okay, we don't do any of those things. V'noheged shvit ha'aretz midivrehem, and Shemitah applies midirabonon. V'chol Shemitah's kesafim, v'chol makom midivrehem, and also release of loans is also derabbanon. Explicitly, it says it's derabbanon. Okay, what are you going to do? Which is the accurate girsa? Which way does the Rambam really jump? Now, elsewhere he links Shemitah with truma, and says that whatever applies to truma applies to Shemitah. And elsewhere he explicitly says that truma today is midirabbanon. Oh, so now I know. That Rambam elsewhere gives us the clues that really he holds Shemitah is the Rabbanon, because Shemitah equals Truma, and Truma is the Rabbanon. Why is Truma the Rabbanon though? Nothing to do with Yovel. Truma and Yovel have nothing to do with each other. Truma is dependent on the majority of the Jews in Eretz Israel returning to Eretz Israel. It's what's called Biat Kulchem. It doesn't mean every Jew has to be there. We had a whole shir on this. Remember a few months ago? And therefore, now if I say, okay, so the Rambam says that Shemitah equals Truma, same halacha, but Truma is not dependent on Yovel, it's dependent on more Jews making aliyah, or more Jews having babies, whichever you look when you look at it. So if you say that the Rambam says Truma is Shemitah is the Rabbanon because of that reason, then maybe that's going to change. Almost has. But if you say, no, it's all to do with Yovel, Shemitah and Yovel are interlinked, then Shemitah is going to be the Rabbanon for the long-term foreseeable future, until someone brings back all the 10 lost tribes, wherever they are, whether they're the American, Native Americans, or whether they're the Scots, There were opinions of that nature, that the Scots were actually the 10 lost tribes. If that's the case, then oy vavoy. We'll see what's going to be. But whatever, we'll see. Apologies to any Scottish people who may be listening. But we'll see. Mashiach will resolve all of those issues. But now we are left with a major problem. Which way are we going to jump on this question? Is Shemitah independent of all of these things and Doraisa? Is it linked with Yovel and therefore long-term Darabonon? Or is it linked with Truma, in which case short-term Darabonon? So have a look here. I brought you a number of different the Rishonim. I could have brought you all of the opinions, but I haven't got time. Rambam, apparently, Rashi, Rashba, Ritva, Ran, Yadra, Matur, other Rishonim hold Darabonon. The Ramban and the Rosh clearly hold Doraisa. Also, there are other views, by the way. The Riva, the Meiri, the Balama Or seem to say that Shemitah today is not evil at Darabonon. It's a Midat Chassidut. It's something we do as a chumrah, etc. That's not really a halachically binding opinion, but it's out there. Similarly, the Achronim are divided. I brought you a whole list of people who hold different ways. The Bach, the Sma, the Avni, Nezer, Rav Kook, the Chazon Ish, Rav Chaim Ozer, the Rav Waldenberg, Rav Avadi Yosef, all held that Shemitah today is the Rabbonon, basically. However, the Beis Halevi and the Netziv, very important, strong 19th century opinions, held very strongly that it is Doraisa, and this is an unresolved question. However, the Heta Mechira resolves that question in favor of the Heta Mechira by saying Shemitah today is Darabonon. And once it's Darabonon, you have the ability to start creating a Heta, we'll see what the Heta is, that will remove some of the crisis in the agricultural sector on Shemitah. Now, what I want to do with you for the next half hour is look at that historical outline. Don't forget, we think of the Heta Mechira, most people in this room, as an issue as consumers. We go to the shops, we're looking at these vegetables or those vegetables. Really, the Heta Mechira historically has been an issue for the farmers. You know, they're the people who have to lose their whole livelihood potentially over the year. We just choose these vegetables over those vegetables. So the Heta Mechira was brought in not to help you and me in the supermarket, but to help the farmers who actually were going to lose all of their livelihood. So let's look together. I've brought you quite a lot of photographs. I feel with this historical stuff, it's nicer to have some of the pictures of the Rabbonim in front of us. They've actually come out quite well in the copying, Baruch Hashem, although it took me an extraordinary amount of time to get my computer to put all the little names in all the right places, because I'm still using Dafka Writer, which is, I swear by, is a wonderful word processing package, although it does place me very firmly in the mid-1990s. But never mind, it works as far as I'm concerned. I will continue as long as I can. The new Yishuv in Eretz Israel. Yes, sir? Well, this is what we're going to do now. The Heta Mechira in modern terms is a system whereby farmers may sell their fields to a non-Jew. We won't say Arab, because we'll see soon that it's not anymore an Arab. That makes a difference halachically. And we'll see how long they sell them for, but certainly during the Shemitah year. So that during that year, the field is owned by a non-Jew. And then it may be permitted for either the Jew to do certain actions, or to Jew to do rabbinic actions, or certainly to get in non-Jews to do actions in a non-Jewish field, non-Jewish owned field, during the Shemitah year. And that way they can plant, potentially, certainly water, reap, sell commercially, etc. Because like we said last week, there's two real issues. There's how I grow the crops, and there's how I gather them and sell them commercially. Everyone agrees that you can gather crops and eat them on an individual basis. We talked about that last week, a little bit for a family, but that's not good enough if you're a commercial farmer. You need to be able to bring the crop in and sell it out. Okay, fine. So let's have a look at some of this. Until 1867, this was a theoretical question. Even though classically the Beis Yosef, the Mabit, the post-Gim in Eretz Yisrael discuss it, until the mid-1800s, Jews were not allowed to own land in Eretz Yisrael. No, non-Muslims were not. And it's only after pressure by the British, after the Crimean War, you have to learn your mid-19th century history and politics to work out where the Ottomans needed to jump in order to try and gain favour in Europe. There was pressure put on the Ottomans that the Christians wanted to come in and buy up land and build churches. And in fact, if you look at the churches around Jerusalem, most of the Anglican churches, they were all built after this period. They're all late 1800s because they were not allowed to own land in before that. So once the 1867 marker came and went, then Jews could buy land. And in fact, in 1870, the French Alliance Israélite Universelle, forgive me if I didn't pronounce that wrong, I've now upset all the French people and the Scottish people, but that's okay. They founded an agricultural school called Mikveh Israel. If you want to go there today, it is just at the north part of Rehovot. If you go to Yafo and you drive in, it's now a little museum. This was the original agricultural school. It was not run along observant lines. They were French speakers. They were non-observant Jews. And they couldn't really care less about Shemitah when it came along in 1874-5. Even though Rabbonim at the time in Poland said, listen, now you own land. It's a serious business. You've got to work out Shemitah. They really weren't so bothered, and it didn't really cause a problem. At least for them, it may have been a major halachic problem. Don't forget, the towering figures in Europe at the time in Tzach were the Netziv and the Beis Halevi, very much, who I brought you pictures of here, who very much held that Shemitah was da'oraita and had to be kept in all its chumras. All of this, of course, changed when the first Aliyah started in the late 1870s, early 1880s. And I've brought you here a little map, which I got from this book as well, and a list of the early Yeshuvim, Petach Tikva, Rosh Pina, Zichron Yaakov, Rishon Lezion, Maskeret Batya, which was also called Ekron, Gedera, which we'll see soon, is relevant, Rehovot, Chadera, Metula, and Kfar Saba, and Atlit. And then in the second Aliyah, later we see the Kibbutzim begin, and Ben Shemin, etc. Now, the first Aliyah was mostly religious Jews that came from Russia. Many of them were actually farmers. They had farming expertise. I know we always have this image of these clueless, you know, yeshiva bokrim arriving off the boat from Russia and not knowing what to do. That was not true, really. Finkel, in his book on the rebels in the Holy Land, he's clear what a lot of these people knew what they were doing. They had expertise, but they needed to buy the land and they needed infrastructure. Now, Petach Tikva was set up in 1878. I kind of married into a Petach Tikva reality because my daughter married an eighth generation Petach Tikvi, who's actually named after one of his great-great-grandfather, who's one of the founders. So Petach Tikva is in their blood. And then they haven't really left Petach Tikva since 1880, a lot of the family members, a little bit here and there. And there was, but unfortunately, it was in the middle of malaria swamps. And therefore, really, it was malaria that finished off Petach Tikva at the beginning. And only in the 1880s, when the baron gave them enough money to drain the swamps, they were able to really settle the yeshuv. But those who were living in Yeshuvim in this first Shemitah year of 81-82, most of them followed the Psak of Rav Shmuel Salant. Rav Shmuel Salant, we'll see him over the page, was the head of the old yeshuv in Yerushalayim. He held that it was absolutely also to do any agricultural work on during Shemitah on the land. And Eliezer ben Yehuda, who a little picture of him over on the right there, he actually supported this. He felt it would be in his interest to win favor with the old yeshuv. He had just arrived. He was a young man. He wanted to get them on his side and persuade them to be a bit more Zionist. It didn't take him very long to realize it was not going to be possible to persuade the old yeshuv to be tzioni, and here we are 140 years later, and it's still not so straightforward, okay? But Eliezer ben Yehuda originally supported it, but you'll see soon he quickly changed his mind. But that first Shemitah, whatever there really was, people mostly followed the party line. They didn't do any work on the land. But all the action happens in the next Shemitah. Go over to page 5. How did they survive? I'm not sure exactly how. There were very few of them. The old yeshuv, don't forget, was survived based on the chalaka. They got money from the chutz la'aretz, and they fed through. They gave people subsistence, provisions, bread, whatever, and they did. Only later, by 1888, you had a significant infrastructure. In 1882, there wasn't really much yet. But by 1888, Rav Shmuel Moaleva, one of the main founders of Chovevei Tzion, he had persuaded the baron, Edmund de Rothschild, to invest vast amounts of money. I mean, we're talking $100 million over the course of the 20, 30 years then, which is phenomenal amounts of money that Baron Rothschild put into Yeshuvim. By 1888-9, there were already Yeshuvim which were serious agricultural investments. Now, Chovevei Tzion was very unusual. Of course, around the corner, you've got the shul on the street, Chovevei Tzion. Chovevei Tzion was an organization which was a collaboration between early religious Zionist leaders like Rav Moaleva and non-religious Zionist thinkers like Leon Pinsker. And the idea of having an organization which was run by religious and secular Jews was viewed with some, let's say, suspicion by the traditional Orthodox establishment as being something which they were not sure exactly how this is going to work. Eventually, the religious elements of Chabad Beit Sion felt that they could not get on with the non-religious element, and they span off to their own organization, which they called the Mizrahi movement. Mizrahi, which they said was from Merkaz Ruchani. We want it to be a center which is spiritual, and of course Mizrahi is alive and well today, actually much better than it was maybe 5-10 years ago. So Chabad Beit Sion was Rav Moyeh Leiber, and he persuaded the Baron. I brought you a couple of pictures of the Baron. We have an image I certainly do in my mind of the Baron as an old man, but actually he was a very young man at this stage, Edmund de Rothschild. He had a bit of a mishigas in his head that you should invest in Eretz Israel. Everybody around him in his French secular society told him he was completely bonkers. Like, what on earth are you doing? The Arabs are going to just take this over and it's all going to end in ruin. But he had a very strong mission, he felt, to do this. And then, he probably never even heard of Shemitah. And then as they approached the Shemitah year, so the farmer said to him, well, thank you very much for the last like 4 or 5 years of enormous investment, but you do realize we're not going to be able to do any agricultural activity from next September till the following September. And he went to Rav Shmuel Salant and he said, is this true? And Rav Shmuel Salant said, yes, it is true. There are accounts that the Baron actually agreed with Rav Shmuel Salant, but later on they said, well, he didn't really know what he was talking about because they had an interpreter in Yiddish between them, because the Baron spoke French and the Rav Salant spoke Yiddish, and it wasn't clear. The Baron was just nodding because he was very excited to be with Rav Shmuel Salant, but it's not clear what he actually really agreed with. When he fully understood that it meant the farmers were going to literally down tools for a year, he said, this is absolutely ridiculous. He ran to Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin, all these names from the 19th century, and said, is this right? And he said, yep, they're going to have to do no work for a whole year. Now, he was very unhappy about this for many reasons. I brought you a few of them. First of all, loss of his investment. He put all of this enormous amount of money in, and he felt that they just need even bigger bailouts now after a whole year of not working. Also, he felt this would prove to other people that he was a friar, that he put all this money into it and it was all going to go wrong. He also felt that he'd been taken for a ride. You know, these people had taken his money for years and years, and now they were like schnorrers, basically. They were going to not do anything. He also, on a philosophical level, he believed that Torah and modernity could coexist. He was an early modern Orthodox kind of thinker, if you like. There was a synergy between them, and this was going to basically defeat that whole worldview. And he also felt that he was trying to get away from the dependency model. His whole thesis was, let's get the Jews independent, financially wealthy independently, so they don't need to run around for handouts. And now here were these Jews running around for handouts. So he basically turned to his own rabbi, Rav Tzadok Kahn, picture of him at the bottom, which I thought was a very nice picture with his canonicals and his medal of Légion d'honneur or whatever he has in France. And he said, you've got to find some heter here. So Rav Kahn said, I can't give you a heter, but I know a man who might. And he went to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spekter. Now, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spekter was the gadol of Lithuania. The Ritz Beis HaMedrash in YU is the Rav Yitzchak Isaac Elchanan Spekter Theological Seminary. So, Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary. So, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to create the Heter Mechira. People mistakenly think Rav Kook created the Heter Mechira. Lo nachon. Rav Kook actually disagreed with the Heter Mechira at this stage. He was still in Russia. But Rav Spekter created the Heter Mechira, and he said that if you sell the land to a non-Jew, then Jews can do derabbanon malacha on the land. And then he tightened it up and said, actually, if you sell the field to a non-Jew, non-Jews can do malacha on the land. So it's like a double derabbanon. You've sold the land to a non-Jew, which he says works. We'll see that next week. And you're only asking non-Jews to work the land anyway, and therefore, on that basis, you're going to be allowed to do it. Now, it was very hard for anyone to get hold of an actual copy of the Psak. What most of the farmers had was a French translation prepared by the baron's people of what they liked the heter to be. Like, nothing really changes, right? People always have, oh, I heard this one said, this rabbi I heard in them. And therefore, the farmers were very unclear what to do. The heter relies on the ideas, as I put here, that Shemitah is drabonon, that the sale in Eretz Israel to a non-Jew will work, which is not poshut, we'll see that next week, and that it's not prohibited to sell the land, and it basically puts multiple levels of Rabbanon together. Shemitah's the Rabbanon, and you sold it to a non-Jew, and you're only doing it through a non-Jew, etc. Yeah?
The whole issue is the Kedusha of the land. What's that got to do with who owns it?
Good. What's that got to do with?
Who owns it?
Good. So we'll see next week. It's not at all clear that it's anything to do with it, because we said already last week in Rav Kook, it's not just you that doesn't have to work, it's the land itself has to rest. And even if you perform rabbinic prohibitions on a permanent basis, that itself is a breach of the Torah mitzvah to put into the land. We'll see all that, absolutely. Not so straightforward.
Also, I believe you said something about the fact that the land was resting when Am Yisrael was in Galut.
Yes.
And obviously there were no Jews who were then...
Right.
Owning the land and it was still rest. Clearly, there's no connection
between ownership and... Correct. Very good. Yeah, absolutely. The land is an independent entity. And also, there's something supremely ironic that the Jewish people in Galut were unable to keep Shemitah. And as soon as they're allowed to buy land, the first thing they do is find a way not to keep Shemitah. Okay? So this was not so straightforward. If you go over the page, please. We'll see Rav Spector based his heter on previous precedent. But the heter was opposed by many rabbonim. Clearly, the Netziv, the Beis Halevi, Rav Eliezer Gordon, I put here, Rav the Orach Hashulchan, who was a big name at the time, Rav Yechiel Michal Halevi Epstein, here I put in the middle. They opposed it. Rav Spector himself, even though he was a very big name, was not beyond criticism. Meanwhile, Chovav Etzion had gone away to try and get another heter. They got Rav Moylever, Rav Yisrael Trunk of Kutna, and the wonderfully named Rav Shmuel Zankville Clapfish of Warsaw. If you're going to have a name, that's the name to have, as far as I can see. Who wanted to give a heter which was even more lenient than Rav Spector's heter, but they said, I mean, we're only going to do it if Rav Spector agrees. That's often how these things work. I've written a sefer, which I'm not going to get into now, and I'm trying to get some haskamas for the sefer, and each of the people I'm asking to says, well, I'll give you haskama if the other guy gives you haskama, kind of thing. So they were prepared in theory, but in practice, not really. The baron said to his people, look, that's it. You've got a heter. No one's frumer than Rav Yitzchak Yechon Spector. If you don't follow the heter, then I'm not giving you any money. Okay, I can hear the baron. I got you a heter. You don't want to follow it? Okay, no money. The old yeshuv, of course, were horrified. They saw the heter as a way of the baron's anti-religious administrators getting around the halacha, the work of anti-religious Jewish nationalists, meaning this was the narrative that they saw everything through, that the heter was created by people who were trying to destroy Judaism. Now, the baron wasn't trying to destroy Judaism, but many of his administrators were quite anti-religious. And they were the people on the ground that the old yeshuv were dealing with, and Eliezer ben Yehuda, who of course came out famous, saying the heter was the way to go, and he publicly declared the chief enemy of the yeshuv in Eretz Israel is Rabbi Shmuel Salant. Okay, so what do you want? So what? Why are you surprised that there is antagonism? You know, old feelings die hard. You know, it's people remember this. There's built-in resentment. I remember Rabbi Wein talking about this once when talking about the army. There are people that still carry with them 150-year-old memories of the rabbis exempting their children from the Russian army and putting other Jewish children into the Russian army. Okay, but it's not 1870 anymore. Okay, in some people's minds, it still is 1870. Sometimes when you open the newspaper, you think that it's 1921, not 2021. But but these things are really built in very strongly. As I said, many farmers were suspicious. They didn't know what the real heter was. In the end, many farmers did rely on the heter. I put here Zichron Yaakov, Nes Ziona did. Maskeret Batya did not. They had a big decision that they were all the way up to Rosh Hashanah, shall we? In the end, they decided not to work, to go against the baron. Very hard. They've just been taking money for the last 5-6 years, and they decided to go against the baron. Ironically, it was actually Gedera, which was run by non-Orthodox Jews. It was a secular yeshuv, but they had a big guru who was Rav Yechiel Michal Pinez, who very much was a mentor to them, who persuaded them not to work. So they actually, it was the non-religious Jews who said, we're not going to rely on the Hetz Mechira. Leon Pinsker went ballistic. He said, this is completely, you're not even from, you don't even keep Shabbos, and you won't rely on the Hetz Mechira, and he made them in the middle of the Shemitah year go back to work. Which, if you think about it, is even worse, because they never even sold the land. But okay, that was the balagan that they had. At this point, the old yeshuv sent out what they called kol mehechal, a voice coming out from the hechal, from Yerushalayim, encouraging Jews all around the world to give money to support farmers who wanted to keep Shemitah by not working the land. And that kol is still there. You open the papers now, people are calling on the non-Jewish, on the Jewish world in the diaspora to support farmers who want to keep Shemitah. We'll see, there's a lot of water gone under the bridge since then, but we'll see that over the next 15-10 minutes. Rav Shimshul Fal Hirsch, Rav Azriel Hildesheimer in Germany, came out very strongly against the Hetzer Mechira, in favor of the farmers who wouldn't work. In fact, just a vignette, that was the last thing that Rav Hirsch did before he passed away 2 or 3 days later, is he issued a statement encouraging his community to give money to support the farmers who were in 1888, who were keeping the Hetz Mechira. The farmers decided to go on a fundraising trip, so they set off around Europe to raise money, and almost everywhere they went, they were met with derision. Which is, yeah, you're the schnorrers that took money from the baron for 6 years and then threw it back in his face. And now you want our money as well. They were not very successful. And to add insult to injury, the year prior to Shemitah was a very poor year for the crops. So they didn't have much food in the storehouse. And the year of Shemitah itself was a bumper year. The rains were amazing. So all those farmers who worked the land on Shemitah had lots and lots of food, which of course Eliezer ben Yehuda was jubilant over. He says, you see, like even God's on our side, because they're these people who kept Shemitah have no money, but everyone who broke Shemitah has money. And Rothschild was left at the end of Shemitah year completely enraged. What's that? No, Jubilee year. You don't have to be, have a Jubilee year to be jubilant. Okay, fine. Okay, so if you want to get into that Shemitah year in more depth, so he, in what I've done in 5-10 minutes, he does in about 150 pages with blow by blow letters, photos. It's a really wonderful book. I strongly advise you reading it. Let's go forward. The next Shemitah year was much more straightforward. Why? Because by the next Shemitah year, most of the frum farmers who'd not kept Shemitah, not kept their heads before, they were already gone. Some of them, quite horrendous stories, were evicted forcibly by the Turkish police on the request of the baron's administrators. The baron often had nothing to do with this himself, but and people tried very hard not to criticize the baron, but the administrators certainly forced people to do what they said, and most people followed the heads over the page, first page 7. Some new people involved now. The chief rabbi of Yafo, who'd been involved in the previous Shemitah, tried to get the old yeshuv to compromise a little bit. I need to go on, I haven't got much time. They tried to get Rav Shmuel Salant and Rav Diskin to compromise, and actually Rav Diskin came up with we'll see next week what became part of the modern-day Hetzer Mechira, which is an alternative, which was, rather than selling the land to a non-Jew for a year, rather just sell the trees to a non-Jew in perpetuity, forever, and the land and the soil around the trees, and that's less of a problem, because then you're not selling the land, you're selling the trees. They came up with this idea. They took it to Rav Yitzchak von Spector and said, are you happy with this? He says, no, I think that's worse. According to me, you're selling something for a year to a non-Jew. According to you, you're selling something forever to a non-Jew. Ah, is it the trees? He wasn't happy, and he said he rejected that and said, I don't think that's good enough for the Hetzer Mechira. Go forward. The next Shemitah year, 1902-3, Rav Diskin had passed away. The main Rav in Yerushalayim was the Aderet, Rav Eliyahu David Tu'umim, who was the father-in-law of Rav Kook, who at this time was trying to persuade Rav Kook to make Aliyah from Boisk and come to Israel, but Rav Kook had not yet come. And he reluctantly was pressured into endorsing the Hetzer Mechira, the kind of the tree version of the Hetzer Mechira. But as I said, that didn't gain much traction. Already by 1909-10, if you go to the next Shemitah, there was a completely new crowd of Rabbonim who were in on the case. Many of the old school had passed away. Rav Saland had passed away, the Aderet, Rav Hertz of Yafo. The new chief rabbi of Yafo was Rav Kook, and Rav Yaakov David Wilofsky was the chief rabbi of Sfat. And there was the Ritvaz. There was a major face-off between Rav Kook and the Ritvaz. The Ritvaz asked Rav Kook to oppose the Heter Mechira. Rav Kook said no, they needed to keep the Heter Mechira. It was necessary because otherwise the agricultural investment would be very severely compromised. He tried to upgrade the Heter. He combined the Heter Mechira now with the tree sale and the land sale, etc. We'll get more onto that next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. But it didn't work. And in the end, the old Yishuv completely boycotted the Heter, even more so than the previous time. And the Ritvaz and Rav Kook both wrote a sefer each, which became two of the main svarim from Rav Kook. It was Shabbat Haaretz, and from the Ritvaz, it was Peyot HaShulchan, and they each wrote a sefer defending their positions. One pro-Heter, one anti-Heter. And these are very important svarim that we have today. And as I say, Rav Kook backed the Heter Mechira, but most of the old Yishuv were clearly against. Over to page 8, please. Rav Kook did stress that he felt the Heter was permitted only because of great need. He said if a farmer can not plough for the year, etc., then that's much better. And he also brought in a new innovation, which we need to talk about, which was Otzer Beis Din. Otzer Beis Din is a completely different mechanism, which doesn't help you with planting. The planting you can't do, but with a fruit crop, where your issue is not really planting, because you don't have to plant the trees are already there, your issue is gathering, harvesting, and distributing. The Otzer Beis Din mechanism enables you to do that. Because as we'll see, what it does is, rather than the farmer who owns the land reaping the crops and then selling them, the Beis Din basically sends in shluchim. The Beis Din own the crop, and they send in their shluchim. And they, on behalf of the Beis Din, sell off the crop to the people. And that you're allowed to do. So the Rav Kook said it doesn't completely solve all the problems for planting at all, but it does solve some of the problems. And it was very strongly supported, by the way, by Rav Chaim Berlin, the Netziv's son. The Netziv, of course, had two sons, 60 years apart, almost. Because the Netziv's first wife he married when he was a teenager, and then his second wife he married when he was a very old man. So his two sons were almost two generations apart from each other, the brothers. One was Rav Chaim Berlin, and the other was Rav Meir Berlin, who became Rav Meir Bar Ilan. And those 50 years was like a whole major shift in the way that everything went. Fine. The next Shemitah year was during World War I, and the need was even greater because the food was very scarce, there was rationing, food shortages, etc. The following Shemitah, 23-24, Rav Kook was now the chief rabbi and continued to support the Heter, etc., and the old Yishuv continued to oppose it. The next Shemitah was Rav Kook's last Shemitah in 30-31. By 37-38, there was an important new player in the field who was the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish had come from Vilna, I believe, in 1933, and he was very much into Shemitah. One of the first sections of his Sefer Chazon Ish that he published was the section on Shemitah in the run-up to Shemitah 37-38. The Chazon Ish, as I mentioned last week, on many issues is more lenient than Rav Kook in Hilchos Shemitah. And therefore the Chazon Ish says, we don't need the Heter Mechira. There are many other areas that we can rely on to avoid having to get into that. Rav Kook was not as happy as that. Rav Kook was not alive anymore. But the Heter Mechira was opposed by the Chazon Ish, who figured that there were other ways to deal with it. And that was really the lineup, if you like, in 44-45, the Chazon Ish versus the new Yishuv. And by 51-52, of course, the State of Israel had been founded. We go over to page 9. The Brisker Rav and Rav Yitzchak Herzog, major figures in the 1950s. Originally, Rav Herzog was not so excited about the Heter Mechira. He wanted to bring in a new procedure whereby the farmer would declare his land hefka. But he said he was persuaded that wouldn't work, and in the end, Rav Herzog issued a letter together with Rav Uziel, the Sephardi chief rabbi, and Rav Zvi Pesach Frank, and they said, we have to rely, Shal Sadchak, I brought it in the box here, the urgent need to rely on the Heter Mechira, and that really laid down the position for the next 50 years. And I've skipped the Shemitahs going all the way through to 2007, that you have the new Yishuv and the chief rabbinate, which is basically in favor of the Heter Mechira. and the old yeshuv, the Haredi establishment, as they became known as against the Hetzer Mechira. What happened over the last three Shemitah years? Let me just whet your appetite. That clock's a little bit fast, by the way. My watch says it's 11 past, so I'll use my 4 minutes. The last three Shemitah years, some important things. In 2007, some of you may remember this, the chief rabbinate basically broke away from its classic position supporting the Hetzer Mechira. And they said, we're going to leave it to the individual rabbinates to decide whether they do or they don't want to support the Hetzer Mechira. And they were taken to the Bagatz because they said, the chief rabbinate has to have a policy. Because many of the individual rabbanuyot turned around and said, well, we're not going to rely on Hetzer Mechira. Now, that's a very big problem. If you're a restaurant in Herzliya, Petach Tikva, Bat Yam, Afula, Ashdod, where the Rabbanut was not going to rely on Tzemachira, what are you going to do? It's going to really restrict the amount, the kind of produce you can bring in. The Begatz said to the chief rabbis that they had to make a decision, and they, in the end, they supported. They tightened up. A lot of important chumras were introduced into the Hetzer Mechira because of this. And they very much supported, or rather, Rav Weitzman, who was a Rav of Tshnuva, still is, wanted to support Otsa Haaretz. The idea of the Otsa based in project was revived. And if you remember, many, many wines from Golan Winery and other wineries from 2008 were Otsa based in wines, which by 2015 there were very few around. Why? Because the Otsa based in ultimately was a financial disaster. And we'll see that had a big impact on the modern Shemitah question in this year as well. Because the hope was, this is an ideal solution. It has Kedusha Shvius. It's not relying on the Hetzer Mechira, etc. No one works the land. But what they discovered is that no one wanted to buy the stuff. Most of the Israelis couldn't care less, and the Hetzer Mechira is good enough for them. The Haredim are nervous. We don't even know what Otsa based in is, and you're telling me it has Kedusha Shvius. Just take it away and tell me when it's all over. Kind of, we'll talk about that next week. And the small religious Zionist community that was very excited about the Otsa based in idea was just not enough to buy all this wine. I mean, the real problem is that people don't drink enough wine in this country. Clearly, I mean, that was the answer. No one came up with the idea that everyone in the religious Zionist community should drink a bottle of wine every couple of days. But as an Englishman, I think that would have been an ideal solution. But for somehow or other, Israelis don't go for it. Last Shemitah, you can read this on your own, but last Shemitah there were a few new things. First of all, instead of selling to an Arab, they sold to a Ukrainian Israeli Ger Toshav who has a Jewish grandfather. Okay, so we'll see next week why that makes a difference. And the Rabbanut, if you look at the last page, you can see here, the Rabbanut did an interesting thing. This will be an introduction to next week. They said, what we're going to introduce is something called Shemitah Kehilchata. Shemitah like the Halacha, Mahadrin, which basically meant you buy your vegetables from Gaza. Okay, and then regular Shemitah, which relies on the Hetzer Mechira. They put this two-tier system, and this was all from 2015. You can read this what they put out. I have not yet found that they've put out their policy. I looked all around. I can't find yet a Rabbanut policy for Shemitah 2022. But from in 2015, they had a two-tier system, what they called Shemitah Mahadrin, which was basically non-Jewish produce, and regular Shemitah. Zohar, you can read this again in your own time, put out a long policy statement saying you can hardly call buying your vegetables from Gaza Shemitah Mahadrin. That's called Yivul Nochri. That's called avoiding the problem. I get it. I understand it. But don't call it Shemitah Mahadrin. It's not Mahadrin. And therefore, they supported Hetzer Mechira and Otsa Beis Din. We'll see. And that's where we are. The big hot news, which we'll pick up on next week, is that Rav Weitzman, who is a Rav of Alon Shvut, and the chief rabbi of Tznuva, just announced it this week that for the first time in 35 years, he will not be supporting the Otsa Beis Din concept. He pushed it and pushed it and pushed it and pushed it, and he said he doesn't feel that he can with a full heart encourage farmers and wineries to invest in this when people won't buy the produce. And therefore he's turned around and said, either you follow the Haredi model and you don't do anything for a year and we'll try and support you, or you rely on the Hetzer Mechira and let's find ways to improve the Hetzer Mechira. This is a major blow for the Otsa based in project, because Rav Weitzman was a very senior figure who was pushing it. There still is, and we'll get to the Otsa based in and Otsa based in Otsa Haaretz, who I put there, the based in at the bottom, Rav Ariel, Rav Lior, Rav Shmuel Eliyahu, the names that you've come to know with this. But without Rav Weitzman, it's going to be an uphill struggle in some ways. We'll see. We'll see. One of the big victories of the Otzer Beis Din in the last Shemitah cycle is that the army decided to go with Otzer Beis Din instead of Hetzer Mechira. Because the army actually is incredibly influential. They are by far the biggest consumer of food, of vegetables and fruit, etc. in the country. And what they decide has an impact. And they decide, because they were more Haredim in the army now, they don't want to go with Hetzer Mechira, we'll do Otzer Beis Din. But they don't want to go with Otzer Beis Din either, because they don't understand but they don't trust it, whatever. So we'll see next week. But that gives us a little bit of a feel, hopefully historically and halakhically, to how did we get to where we are today. And next week we'll pick up on where we are tomorrow, not just where we are today. There's Rav Tashem. Okay.